Well, our study this morning is part 47 of our studies of systematic theology. It's part 14 of our studies of ecclesiology, or the doctrine of the church, and part 4 of our studies in church history. Last Lord's Day, in our study of what is known as the apostolic era, of the church, which lasted from approximately 30 AD to 100 AD, we looked at one of the subsections within this particular time frame, which was the era of expansion, 48 to 64 AD. We began to look at the era of persecution as well. And we noted that this era of persecution was not really a standalone block of time, but that persecution did, in fact, extend well beyond 100 AD. But as you'll recall, we kind of put the end at 100 AD because that is the close of the apostolic era. In fact, as we go through this study week after week, you're going to see that persecution actually has continued until this very day. But it did begin sometime within this era of persecution, 64 AD, that's when it began in earnest. That's when it really took another face, as it were, because now not only did you have persecution coming from the Jews and the other naysayers, including the pagans, the Gentiles, the surrounding nations, what we witnessed in this time frame in particular is governmental or institutionalized persecution. And again, we talked about that at great length. Let me just give you a little bit of a reminder of what we talked about. This period of persecution was marked by this sudden shift in the way the Roman authorities viewed the church. Remember, up until 64 AD, the Romans, everywhere they would go, when they would establish dominance in a place, they would leave people's cultures intact. They would leave their religions intact, namely because this was the best way to keep them settled. This was the best way to not cause any more hatred toward them than would automatically be there having conquered them. And so they would leave these things intact, and they stayed intact for the most part until Nero. Nero was, by all accounts, a crazy man. He was an extreme narcissist, and you'll recall that he wanted to see the city of Rome sacked. He wanted to see the city of Rome completely laid waste so that he could rebuild it in a more spectacular fashion and call it Neropolis. He wanted it to be named after himself. And so on the 19th of July in 64 AD, he saw to it that the city was set ablaze. The blaze burned for some 10 days, consuming a major portion of the city. And then to deflect suspicion away from himself, he did what? He accused the Christians. The Christians did it. They're the ones that set Rome, the beloved city, on fire. And what was the reaction of the typical Roman citizen? They were incensed. They were tremendously angered, and they went after the Christians. And what happened once word got out that the Christians had done this, not only in Rome, but in all of the other areas in the Roman kingdom, Christians began being persecuted in great numbers. But again, once this fuse had been lit, it would continue to burn even to this day. There's a great deal of hatred for people of the Christian faith. But they did get a respite. In 313 AD. 313 AD was when Constantine became the Roman emperor, and he and Licinius signed the Edict of Milan, which was an agreement to make Christianity legal and give a reprieve to the Christians from this widespread period of persecution. Of course, that wouldn't last very long. Peace rarely lasts very long at all before others come in and try to disrupt that peace. And it's happened with Christians, like I said, since about 64 AD, at least on a governmental or institutionalized level. As I pointed out last week, it was during this initial period of persecution that most of the apostles were martyred. Peter was crucified upside down. Paul was beheaded. Andrew, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, Simon the Zealot, Judas, Thaddeus, and Matthias, along with several prominent believers mentioned in the New Testament, were actually martyred during this time frame. Barnabas, John Mark, Epaphras, Priscilla and Aquila, Silas, and on it goes. 1st and 2nd Peter were written during this time frame. Hebrews was written during this time frame, as well as Jude and 2nd Timothy. Now, we ended our discussion last Lord's Day at 70 A.D. And what happened in 70 A.D.? The destruction of Jerusalem. The destruction of Jerusalem. While Nero had died 2 years earlier, he killed himself in 68 A.D., a man by the name of Gessius Florus was serving now as the procurator ruling all of Judea. And he ruled from 66 A.D. to 70 A.D. And unlike his predecessors, Gessius Florus was not very accommodating either to Jew or Christian. Gessius Florus was a man on a mission. Gessius Florus was a man devoted wholly to the Roman system. He was devoted wholly to Caesar as Lord. And he just could not stand these split allegiances where the Jews claimed to worship the one true God, the Christians claimed to worship Jesus as Lord. Gessius Florus wanted nothing to do with that. And so when tax revenues began to wane from among his own people, he began stealing silver from the Jewish temple. Let me tell you, folks, if you're going to pick a crime to commit in first century Judea, you're not going to rob the temple of its silver. And he did that. Pilfered from the Jews in great quantities to kind of absorb this blow that was happening with his own tax base. And the Jews went nuts. What happened? Well, they began in about 66 AD, shortly after he took power and stole from them. In 66 AD, they began to plot against him. Recognizing that they were plotting against him, he actually sent Roman troops into Jerusalem, and 3,600 citizens were massacred. This massacre touched off an explosive rebellion that's known historically as the First Jewish Revolt. A lot of you know all this. Many of you don't know much of this. And I'm not going to go over every last detail, but this Jewish revolt, this First Jewish Revolt, was a monumental bookmark in the pages of history. It began at Masada. Anybody know what Masada was? Yes. Yeah, it was a fortress. A really formidable fortress, sat high atop a cliff, and it overlooked the Dead Sea. And there was a particular Jewish group that got the bright idea that they would actually raid the fortress at Masada, where all the Roman troops in that area were garrisoned. This group was known as the Zealots. You've probably heard of this. If you want a really good account of this, I would recommend Josephus's Jewish War. I would also recommend 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Apocryphal books, but great in terms of a lot of their history that they provide. They provide a Jewish look at what happened during this Jewish revolt. But this Jewish group attacked Masada. Once they did that, this emboldened the temple captain in Jerusalem, and he stopped the practice of offering daily sacrifices to Caesar, which, as you can imagine, further depleted the coffers of Rome, at least in that area. The Jews began to kill Roman soldiers. They began to expel them from the city, and the revolt soon spread beyond Jerusalem into Judea and Galilee. In an attempt to quell this Jewish uprising, it wasn't long before Roman governor Cestius Callus, marched from Syria with 20,000 soldiers. 20,000 soldiers, and they encircled Jerusalem. And they laid siege to Jerusalem for 6 months. Did he succeed? No. Can you imagine? I mean, we often downplay the strength of the Jewish resistance. But this Roman cohort, this 20,000 soldiers, besieged Jerusalem for 6 months. And they couldn't take the city. More than 6,000 of those Roman soldiers fell. But the Jewish defenders picked up and used their own weapons against the remaining Roman soldiers. And they routed the entire 20,000, the remaining of that, and sent them packing. Now, Nero was still alive at this time. You can only imagine Nero's response. Nero sent his most decorated general, Vespasian, and all of his troops to put down the rebellion. He started, you know, by making a circle around Jerusalem in the outlying areas, and he would work his way inward and kill everyone he could encounter on the way in. This was often the way Romans defeated cities. They would encircle you from pretty far away, and then they would move their troops inward until they would put a stranglehold on you and you'd be forced to give up. Then you'd be sold into slavery or killed on the spot. But just before he could attack, Nero died. This put everything in political turmoil. Nero sends Vespasian to do his bidding, to take over Jerusalem. Nero dies. Who's the next in line to become the emperor? Vespasian. And so now he's distracted by political ambition, no doubt. Took him a while to get situated now, not as the top general, but as the emperor of Rome. And so Vespasian ends up giving the responsibility for sacking Jerusalem to his son. Who was his son? Titus. And thus began what we know as the Jewish War. 14 April, 70 AD. It's when this started. What's significant about 14 April? Come on, guys. Yes. 14th of Nisan on the Jewish calendar. 14th of April is Passover. Who has come from everywhere to Jerusalem during Passover? Jews. And lots of them. So in a very strategic move, Titus decided that he would attack the city. And again, if you want to read more of this, you can read it from Josephus. Josephus actually was a friend of Titus. He was a turncoat. He was a Jewish rabbi to begin with, and then he became a Roman chronicler or historian. But he was a friend of Titus, and he wrote all about this in his classic Jewish War. But Titus began attacking Jerusalem in 66 AD. Jerusalem fell after 4 years of all-out war. Now imagine that. 4 years it took to besiege the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem fell. According to Josephus, more than 1,100,000 people were killed, and 97,000 Jews were captured and enslaved. The city was destroyed. Now, how did they destroy cities back then? Huh? They'd burn them. Some of you, you know, are thinking, well, how do they? Most of it was stone. Most of it was limestone or sandstone. How do you burn limestone or sandstone? Can that be done? Yes. Yes. They literally laid waste to the entire city of Jerusalem. And it was so devastating that they actually, the Roman soldiers, cleared the entire area and laid down a layer of salt about an inch thick over every piece of dirt they could find so that nothing would grow there for decades. That's how thorough they were in ransacking Jerusalem. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, that's all well and good. That's all very exciting. Or maybe that's all very boring. What does all this have to do with Christians? You know, again, too bad for the Jews. But what's this have to do with me as a believer? What does 70 AD have to do with me as a Christian? Well, it's important that we know about this because in the first place, like we kind of talked about last week, it forced the Christians living in and around Jerusalem to flee. To flee where? Everywhere. Taking what with them? The gospel. You see, in these large city centers, in these large hubs, in these large areas, people were prone to stay forever. And so here's a bunch of Christians, a bunch of Jewish believers as well, who had gotten the gospel, and their natural tendency would have been to just stay where they're at. And here comes God and says, oh, no, no. You're going to go like you've been commanded, and you're going to carry the gospel to the utter ends of the known world. How best to do that but lay waste to their city? So that's the first thing. Secondly, the destruction of Jerusalem serves as one of the most vivid pictures or reminders of what happens when God exercises his judgment on unbelievers. And this is probably the most sobering thing to consider about this. Jerusalem was assumed to be impregnable, unassailable. This is the city of David. This is God's eternal city. Not to steal that from Rome, they call Rome the eternal city. But Jerusalem was genuinely thought to be the greatest city in the world, and it was thought to be God's habitation. And so, if anybody had suggested in 66 AD, prior to all this starting, that Jerusalem would fall, they would have been laughed out of existence. What kind of parallels do we see in our own thinking about this country? This country could never fall. This country could never fail. We're too big. We're too prosperous. Too successful. Oh yeah, we're Christians. We're a Christian nation under the blessing of God, the eternal blessing of God. And I would say the same thing that God said to Jerusalem. No, no, no. Because Jerusalem, if there's ever been a picture of God's judgment on an unbelieving people, Jerusalem has to be it. As most credible theologians agree, the destruction of Jerusalem was actually the primary fulfillment of a great number of prophecies. You know, God knew all along that this was going to happen. The Jews should have known that this would happen. Look at Micah chapter 3. Micah chapter 3. Begin in verse 9. What does the prophet say? Now hear this, heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and twist everything that is straight. Sound familiar? Who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with violent injustice. Sound familiar? Her leaders pronounce judgment for a bribe. Her priests instruct for a price. And her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? Calamity will not come upon us. Therefore, on account of you, Zion will be plowed as a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins. Pretty eye-opening, right? Seems like most of the prophets that the Jews in 70 AD revered above every other living being were not heeded. Look at Luke 21. Even Jesus prophesied about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Now let me just say this. This is probably the most eschatology you're going to get out of me ever. I just don't dabble in eschatology. There's too much conjecture. There's so much we don't know. There's so much speculation. I'm not about speculation. I figure, you know, we have a short time on this earth, and that time is better spent talking about things in the scriptures that we can understand. It's not to downplay eschatology. Eschatology is crucially important. But I will still say this. As a believer, all you need to know as far as eschatology goes is that Jesus has ascended to the right hand of the majesty on high, and he's coming back. When? I don't know, and neither do you. I noticed on Friday night at the football game, we had another blood moon. Sorry, John Hagee, but you're about 14 blood moons past your prophetic utterances. Why he's still inhabiting a pulpit, the world only knows, right? Luke 21, verse 5. And let me also say this before I read this. There are a lot of people who read Jesus' prophecies and they automatically assign their fulfillment to a date that's even future to us. And that's good because there's a lot of that going on. But you got to understand, Jesus was also uttering prophecies that concerned the very people he was talking to. Right? We can see that in the language. Luke 21, 5. Let's just read 5 through 9, first of all. While some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, as for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be one stone left upon another. Not one stone which will not be torn down. They questioned him, saying, teacher, when therefore will these things happen? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? And he said, see to it that you're not misled. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is near. Do not go after them. When you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified. For these things must take place first. Listen to what he says very carefully next. But the end does not follow immediately. Did you get that? Jesus is indicating that the destruction of Jerusalem would only mark the beginning of the end, culminating, of course, with his return in both judgment and to gather his children together. So historically speaking, what were the Christians experiencing before, during, and after the destruction of Jerusalem? Well, you'll notice, first of all, that in verses 10 and 11, Jesus talks in very general terms about what will happen in the time frame between the destruction of Jerusalem and his return, right? So he's talking about three periods of time in this one prophecy. He's talking about the days leading up to the destruction, the days immediately following the destruction, and the days well beyond the destruction of Jerusalem. If you understand that, you'll understand this particular prophecy a lot more clearly. He says, nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes, and in various places plagues and famines. There will be terrors and great signs from heaven. In other words, things are going to continue from that point forward to get worse and worse. But notice what he says beginning at verse 12. He says, but before all these things... Before all what things? The earthquakes, the famines, the kingdom against kingdom, nation against nation, which, by the way, we've seen since 70 AD, right? Still seeing it happen today. But before all these things, that is in the near term for them, they, their tormentors and captors, Jesus says, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you. delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. But you will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death, and you will be hated by all because of my name. Yet not a hair of your head will perish. Doesn't mean they won't die, right? Just means they won't perish. Remember what perish means? They won't be consigned to that place of eternal destruction. If you're truly a believer, if you're doing what you've been commanded to do and called to do and equipped to do, then not a hair on your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. Now, let's pause here for a second. How do we know that Jesus is talking here about the days leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem? How do we know that? We know that because if we keep reading, Jesus tells us that. What does he say? But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, prophecy doesn't get clearer than that. Rarely does prophecy get clearer than that. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. When did it happen again? 70 AD, some 40 years after Jesus is saying this. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. How many of you, honestly speaking, have been taught to believe that that's a reference to the end days? The last hurrah, right? I mean, especially if you're a dispensationalist. I mean, they believe that this is strictly reserved. This is language that can only be applied to still future dates when all this starts to happen. If we continue reading from verse 25, here's where we should be able to see that Jesus transitions from talking about the fairly near future, that time frame leading up to 70 A.D., he transitions from talking about that to talking about the future as we know it. A more distant future that runs all the way up to the time of his glorious return. Read it with me, beginning at verse 25. There will be signs in the sun and moon and stars, and on the earth dismay among nations in perplexity. At the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world. There's one of your clues. He's not using the word world there just to refer to Jerusalem. He's not using the word world there just to refer to Judea. He's using the word world there literally. The time he's talking about now will be witnessed by the whole world. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Now, how do we know he's talking about a time still future? Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. By the time you see Jesus, the Son of Man, Son of God, appearing in the clouds, I would argue it's kind of too late. Right. I mean, because when that happens, you can be assured that the end has come. At that point, it's not coming. It has come. Because if you read the latter chapters of Revelation, how will he appear? What does it mean when it says he'll appear with power and great glory? He'll be on a white horse. He'll have a name written on his thigh that's known by no man except himself. But it will say what? King of kings and Lord of lords. The vultures will begin to gather. the armies of heaven will crash down upon this earth, exacting God's vengeance on the entire planet. Now, I realize that eschatology, the study of the last things, end times, it's difficult sometimes for most of us. And there are many who will look at this particular passage and passages like this, and they say, yeah, we can see where much of what Jesus predicted would happen actually happened in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem. But again, what does all that have to do with me as a 21st century Christian? Well, we need to understand that even those prophecies made about the destruction of Jerusalem, even those prophecies can have a secondary fulfillment or a tertiary fulfillment. They can have as many fulfillments as the Lord deems they should have. And this is one such example. The primary fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy was witnessed largely, without that latter part, largely it was witnessed in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem. What we need to understand, however, is that the destruction of Jerusalem was itself a shadow or a type or a foreboding or a foreshadowing of the destruction of all things that will take place at the last day when Jesus returns in glory to complete our redemption by taking us to our eternal home. This is how we can best explain Jesus' continuing prophecy there in verses 25 through 28. Now, I've said this before, and you need to be aware of this particular group of people. There are some who call themselves preterists, full preterists. You know, as R.C. Sproul once said, we're all preterists to some degree. A preterist simply means, preterist is one who believes that the messianic prophecies concerning the end times have already taken place. The partial preterist, which is what you are, even if you didn't know it, you can walk out here this morning and say, I'm a partial preterist. You're a partial preterist because you do see the validity of the prophecies Jesus made regarding 70 AD. It's undeniable. When you tie that back with the Old Testament prophets, it's undeniable that's what Jesus was talking about primarily. The full preterist, though, says that everything prophetically that is to happen happened on 70 AD. In other words, there's nothing left on God's prophetic calendar. It's all done. There's no future appearance that we should expect from the Lord besides the sudden ingathering of God's people. And they firmly believe that. Okay, what do they do with the book of Revelation? Well, in order for them to be right, the book of Revelation had to have been written prior to 70 AD. Not possible. It's not possible. Why? Because where did John write his revelation from? Patmos. He was exiled to the Isle of Patmos. When? 95 AD. Between 93 and 95 AD. How do we know that? We know that the earliest source we have for that, I believe, is Irenaeus. Irenaeus, a disciple of Polycarp. Polycarp was a disciple of John himself. And Polycarp knew that it was written in around 95 AD. So what does that do to the preterist argument? Makes it invalid. Because much of what John writes in his revelation, as you well know, deals with a future time when all of these other things are going to take place. The preterist error that we see today was the exact error that Paul warned Timothy against in 2 Timothy 2, 16 through 18. You might not be as familiar with that as you should be, but there he said, avoid worldly and empty chatter, for it will lead to further ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene. Give us an example. Who are you talking about, Paul? Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus. Men who have gone astray from the truth, in what way? Saying that the resurrection has already taken place. And they upset the faith of some. Even early on, there were people saying that it's all done. Jesus has gone to heaven. The last thing that remains is for him to come back and retrieve us, and that's it. No more doomsday prophecies, no more destruction, no more judgment in terms of what prophecy tells us is coming. It's all done. Well, the best defense that we have against this erroneous notion can actually be found back in Luke 21, verses 34 through 36. And remember, Jesus is still talking about this future time, future even to us. He's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. How do we know? Listen to what he says. Be on guard, so that your hearts will not be weighted down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of life, and that the day will not come on you suddenly like a trap, for it will come upon all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Oh. It's not Jerusalem. The things he's talking about now are going to come upon all those who dwell on the face of the earth. But keep on the alert at all times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. Now, we got a problem here. This is one of those passages that the naysayer loves to grab onto in an effort to convince you that Jesus didn't know what he was talking about. The naysayer will say, Jesus says that these things are about to take place. And he's talking to these individuals at this time as though they'll be alive when it all goes down. What can we make of that? How do we defend against that? Because he is talking to a particular group of people about this particular destruction. And he must have been talking to the people who would witness the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. They're the only ones who are alive. They're the only ones who would be alive, many of them, most of them, when this all went down. How do we defend against that? It's simple. Most alleged errors dealing with Scripture are very simple to explain. But as I've said before, and let this be another example of the importance of knowing your Bibles, knowing what the Scriptures say. How do we deflect that particular claim of error in the Scriptures? Matthew 24:36, one verse, can explain away that entire alleged error. Speaking of the end of days, Matthew 24:36, Jesus said, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. We've talked about the hypostatic union of Christ. 100% God, 100% man. We've talked about the kenosis, which is Jesus' willingly divesting himself, not of his divinity, but divesting himself and relinquishing the prerogative to use some of his divinity. One of the things he did in divesting himself as the man Jesus, he chose, for whatever reason, not to know. Now, could he have tapped into his divinity as he did when he did miracles, as he did when he did a lot of things? Could he have tapped in and said, wait just a minute, here's when it's going to happen? Yes. He could have, but he didn't. He chose not to know in the same way that he chose to hunger, he chose to thirst, he chose to weep. He chose to grow in stature and wisdom. He chose to do all of those other human things. He chose not to know. Now, some of you might be wondering, what kind of wisdom is that? He could have very well just said, here's when it's going to happen. You want to know what kind of wisdom it is not to know and not to tell? If you had a date for the return of Christ, which if he had told them back then, it's going to be in the year 2128, I don't know, right? Don't quote me on that. It's not prophecy. But I mean, had he said that, how would they have lived? Got all the time in the world. He's not coming back for a long, long time. So they probably would have adopted the attitude of the Epicureans. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And sometime between now and the time we die, we'll get right with the Lord. But there's no need to do that now. There's no urgency. That's exactly what men would do. You know that's what men would do. So the reason Jesus chose not to know and not to convey that to his disciples was precisely so that they would always be ready. And he does this. So when we read these passages where he says, you be ready, to first century Christians, he's doing that from the perspective of not knowing. In his humanity, he might have very well assumed that he would ascend to the right hand of the Father and then shortly thereafter come immediately back. Remember, he chose not to know. I'm not limiting Jesus. I'm not denigrating Jesus' omniscience. But you got to factor in the hypostatic union and his 100% humanity and the fact that he himself says, I don't know. Does that make sense? He's doing the same thing Paul did. Remember when Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, explaining the sequence of the resurrection? What did he say? The dead in Christ will rise first, and then those of us who are alive and remain will be caught up together to meet them in the clouds. Paul fully expected, even under inspiration, that he would be in the generation that would witness the return of Christ. So it makes perfect sense. Jesus' message here is one of readiness, preparedness. And it's the fact that we're not told, the fact that we don't know, that should keep us spiritually on edge, on our guard, ready. So in a nutshell, what happened in 70 AD should be important to us. Because it reminds us in very vivid language, the historians remind us by way of this foreshadowing that God is just, God is holy, God is righteous, and he'll one day rain down his wrath on the unbelieving world in a way that will make 70 AD look like child's play. Well, very quickly, let's look past 70 AD. What happened in the history of the church for the remainder of the apostolic era? And again, this is the 35,000-foot view. There's a lot that happened. We could literally go on for years talking about what happened even during this last phase of the apostolic era. But let me just hit some of the high points. 79 AD, like his father, Titus becomes the Roman emperor. He reigns until 81 AD. He was followed by Domitian. Domitian reigned from 81 to 96 AD. Domitian's persecution of Christians made Nero's persecution pale in comparison. Far and away, Domitian was the largest persecutor, most hateful, spiteful, degrading persecutor of Christians I think the world has ever known. He was horrible. I'm not going to go into all the details. It's really pointless to do that. But this was the heaviest period of persecution. From about 89, it took him about 8 years to get into full swing, but from 89 to 96, the period of persecution was the heaviest experienced thus far by Christians. Luke was hung in 93 AD. Between 93 and 96 AD, John was exiled to Patmos. And from Patmos, he wrote not only his gospel, but he also wrote the three letters that bear his name, as well as his revelation. Who followed Domitian? Trajan. He reigned from 98 to 117 AD. And it was in 98 AD that Timothy was stoned to death in Ephesus. So, that's the close of the apostolic era. What was happening in terms of doctrine in the church? Church was still largely unaffected by error. As I said the last time we were together and the time before that, there was error. But it was being effectively knocked down, put in its place. And I would say there's one reason for that. And this lasted until 313 AD. One of the reasons error was so easily dealt with is because the emphasis in ecclesiology, the emphasis on the church, was on the local church. It wasn't until 313 AD that you have the church-state system, the joining of the government and the church, which was really the greatest disservice that was ever done to the church. And it continues today, not only in Roman Catholics, but in the Orthodox churches and in most Protestant churches. They still have this church-state sort of setup, or they would long to have this church-state type of setup. And they indeed sprang from that. So, again, until 313 AD, though, the emphasis is largely on the local church. And when the local church is assailed by error, it's much easier to put it down as a local congregation. We've done that here. But what happens, even today, in these vast denominations that have a centrality of leadership and a centrality of focus and a common doctrine among all of them, to which every church under them is beholden, what happens when error is introduced in those churches? Well, we see what happens. This is why you have women in the pulpits. This is why you have homosexuals in the pulpits, in leadership positions in the church. Because all of these things have to be filtered from the individual church all the way up to the magisterium, the big boss, the leader of all of them. And whatever the general assembly decides then gets passed down to all the underling churches. The local church is stripped of her ability to govern herself under the headship of Christ. You see how that works? It really is insidious. The church was more effective at combating error in the earliest days of her existence because there was an emphasis on the local church, answerable only to the chief shepherd himself, Jesus Christ. I get asked all the time, why aren't you guys members of the SBC? Have you seen the SBC lately? There's your answer. Why were we never members of ARPCA? Have you seen ARPCA lately? It's in shambles. And I get invitations weekly. There's this new thing called the Reformed Baptist Network. Want to be a member? Not on your life. I'll pray for you. I'll love you. I'll commune with you. I'll come to your conferences. We'll shake hands and pat each other on the back and do what pastors do after the conferences each night. In fun, right? I'm not going to tell anybody what that is, but we have a great time at those things. But if you're asking me to lock arms with you in solidarity under the banner of this one monolithic group, no thanks. This is the flock that God has given into my care, John's care, Mike's care. This is the flock we shepherd. And I'm not going to have anybody else come in and try to shepherd you. I'm not going to allow anyone else to come in and try to shepherd you. Because that's not what the Scriptures tell us about the church and how she's to be run. So, Lord willing, in our next time together, We're going to look at the time period between 100 and 313 AD. This is where we're going to slow down, right? Because we need to take special care to understand all these little baby steps from 100 AD to 313 AD that resulted in the establishment of the Catholic Church. Now, it wasn't the Roman Catholic Church at the time. It was just the Catholic Church. If you were a Christian, you were expected to be a part of this monolithic structure, this state church monolithic structure under Constantine. And we'll talk about what sprang from that as well at some point down the road. It's going to take us a while to get from 100, you know, cover 213 years. But I'll do my best to make it as painless as possible. I said before, I'll say it again, this era is known as the larger era of transition, because that's when we see this transition from the primitive New Testament local church type of Christianity to a sacerdotal, priest-led state religion that would eventually give rise to the Catholic Church.